You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Mark Twain once said that if you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you read the newspaper, you're misinformed. Well, what would he make of the digital resources we use these days? Web, social media, digital, phone, photos, and record keeping, all delivered, sometimes stolen, at the speed of light, all endlessly alterable and stored forever. Journalist and NYU professor Charles Seif examines evolving problems in the digital jungle in his latest book, Virtual Unreality, Just Because the Internet Told You, How Do You Know It's True? It's published by Viking, and Charles Seif was on our show in June to discuss it. We're re-airing that interview for you today. I began by asking him, people used to say you can't believe everything you read in the paper. Has digital media aggravated an old problem or changed things even more fundamentally?
I think it really is a fundamental shift. Of course, the news media wasn't always trustworthy. Back a century ago, we had stories about moon people running around that were found by Herschel's telescope. So, of course, there were always lies in the media. But what's happened lately is we have become addicted to digital technology. We've become dependent on digital information. And it's almost become a new sense, like as dependent as we are on our site. We're dependent on the internet. But what we don't recognize is that, unlike our other senses, digital information is mediated by other people and by robots and by algorithms that change what we perceive. And so we have a sense which is manipulable by outsiders, and they are doing it. They're manipulating it to change our behaviors and our perception of reality.
You mentioned the internet, and your title does as well, but aren't you concerned with all the ways supposed facts are conveyed digitally, from references like Wikipedia to media like digital photography?
Yes. It used to take the powers of a totalitarian state to try to change people's perception of reality through fake photographs. That you to do it on a large scale, like Stalin did, you needed a couple of bureaus of people with airbrushes. Now, people in their basements can change photographs convincingly, even better than states can. Iran, for example, a couple of years ago, photoshopped a missile launch to make it look like the missile went off, and it actually didn't. But it was such a poor job compared to what the amateurs could do that it was roundly mocked on the internet. That there were headlines, Iran, you suck at Photoshop. And people on the internet kind of started doing better Photoshops, where you had Godzillas and X-wing fighters coming from the Iranian missile launch. It looked more genuine than what the state could provide.
In one of your previous books, Proofiness, you looked at the use of math and numbers to influence thinking. Does the huge volume of digital resources do something similar?
It does. It does. Because we are no longer able to filter information the same way that we once did. We were living in an era where we were starving for information. We could, if we really wanted to, delve into a topic and read almost all the primary sources on a very narrow issue. Now, we have so much information. We have real-time data that's streaming at us that we need the assistance of algorithms and filters and outside helpers to help us filter. And those things are being used against us.
You think the internet and digital technology is being used to systematically distort our understanding of things?
Yes, sometimes by accident, but sometimes deliberately. That if you look at Google News and you search on something, the search is tailored to your preferences, which is a good thing because, of course, you don't want to spend your time looking at news that isn't of interest to you. An algorithm that pulls out stuff that is of interest is valuable. But at the same time, it also limits your worldview to a very narrow window. And
so liberals get liberal news and conservatives get conservative news mostly.
That's right. You get your own predilections mirrored back at you. And so it's like all Fox all the time or all MSNBC all the time. And you never get your views challenged. You never get actual information that makes you change your mind.
Are the problems you point to common to all new technologies that increase how quickly we get information? Orson Welles unintentionally spread fear of a Martian invasion on the radio in 1938. Was that so different from misinformation spread on the net today?
That's a good point. That, in fact, every time that there was a revolution in information, it changed the landscape dramatically. And radio is a very good example of that, that with radio you could transmit at the speed of light to people. You didn't have to make concrete copies. You could spread to, theoretically, an infinite number of people just by broadcasting into the airwaves. And that made things spread much faster. Digital information is kind of the apotheosis of all of these informational revolutions. And if you think about it, digital information has the advantages of radio in that it transmits at the speed of light. You can store things in almost no space at all. It persists forever. It's easily duplicable. You replicate incredibly easily. And I like to think of an epidemiological analogy. What makes a bug turn into an epidemic? It's when the disease is transmitted easily from person to person, and it replicates quickly. So digital information, in some ways, is the most infectious thing on the planet now.
This week, a story broke about a Facebook experiment in which the company tweaked certain users' newsfeed algorithms, and the company then studied how those changes altered people's emotional states. They've kind of apologized for having done that, but not really.
Yeah, and I can't think of a clearer example of how digital information is being used to manipulate you. You think of yourself on Facebook as an entity and a person. This represents you. But in fact, it's something that Facebook presents to you, that you're not actually talking to your friends. You're talking to Facebook. And what Facebook did is they took people's news feeds, and sometimes they removed bad news to see if they can make people happy, and they removed good news to see if they can make others sad. And so this was a direct manipulation of communications from your friends.
And this is different than me entering into some kind of a study knowingly and saying at some university lab that I'm a willing participant.
That's right. The
Facebook, these were not willing participants. Nobody was asked whether they wanted this to happen?
No. According to Facebook, though, that the research participants had given their consent just by signing up to Facebook. The terms of service say you could do research.
Nobody reads that little type.
No, no. It's an old Silicon Valley trick to avoid liability. Click on this to agree, and you have signed over your firstborn son.
My guest is Charles Seif, S-E-I-F-E. His latest book is called Virtual Unreality, Just Because the Internet Told You, How Do You Know It's True? 30 years ago, before the web, the economist Herbert Simon noted that people experience a poverty of attention in the face of the wealth of digital information. What's changed with the World Wide Web?
The volume and extent of information that's at our fingertips, that is everywhere, is unprecedented. That we have, when you're have your mobile phone open or your computer open, you can reach into the data troves that are in the back pocket of someone in Uganda or someone in Great Britain or anywhere around the world. So we've connected all of this information together. And it takes we no longer are limited by the information that's out there. We're no longer starving, but we have to figure out how to toss away information that we don't want and filter the ones that we do.
Can you explain the signal-to-noise distinction?
Yeah. It's in information processing and in signal processing, there's an idea of signal is what you want to hear, what is important to you, what changes your mind, and noise is everything else that distracts you. And there's a ratio of signal to noise. You can hear a soft signal in a quiet room where there's no noise. That you can hear a whisper. If it's noisy, you have to increase the signal to hear it. And in some ways, we have this incredible increase in signal, but an even greater increase in noise. So what's happening is what we want to hear is speaking louder, but the roar around us is so great that we can't hear it anymore.
Did the growth of information accelerate with improvements in science and technology? Did it really begin with the scientific and industrial revolutions?
In fact, you can take it back before that in some ways. That digital information actually goes back to the 9th century, if you want. There were a trio of Baghdad brothers who created these very clever mechanisms for ringing bells based upon digital information. And one of the things that
digital... Do we know if they were Shiites or Sunnis?
Well, I assume they were Sunnis at the point, but yeah. The digital information actually was first used to automate processes, mechanisms like ringing bells, or in the 18th century, moving looms. And so one of the things that digital information does is it automates things, and we figured out in the 20th century how to use digital information to automate the gathering of information. So it's kind of the circular thing where all of a sudden you get this explosion because we are using digital information to automate gathering digital information, gathering digital information.
Aren't Google, Yahoo, Apple, and all the others doing lots of experiments of the sort that Facebook did?
They are. We haven't heard much about it because it wasn't published. What got Facebook into trouble is they tried to publish in a peer-reviewed journal and were held to the standards thereof. But in fact, in my book, I talk a couple of places where you were experimented on without your knowing if you played certain games or signed up to certain services. There was a popular game called Curiosity, What's Inside the Box, which was run about a year ago. And the game was click, click, click to remove layers of a box. And after 3 months of people clicking to remove boxes, one person got to the center and got a prize. So it was millions and millions and millions of clicks for one person's prize. And the designer, Peter Molyneux, admitted that it was just a giant social experiment to see what people's behavior was. So in some ways, you have allowed yourself, if you play these games or sign up for Facebook, to become a digital guinea pig.
You begin your book with a quotation from Marshall McLuhan, the new environment shaped by electric technology is a cannibalistic one that eats people. To survive, one must study the habits of cannibals. He wrote that in 1967, 2 years before ARPANET, the precursor of the Internet, was developed. He began that statement with, "When we invent a new technology, we become cannibals. We eat ourselves alive since these technologies are merely extensions of ourselves." Would he have included even ancient technologies like the wheel into that?
Yeah, I think for communications, for example, the printing press, even the creation of writing, these are extensions of ourselves. If you think about the invention of writing, the beginning of history, before there was writing, an idea generally died with the person who thought it up. That if you had a trained storyteller, maybe it could last for a couple of generations and then wind up as this atavistic, dreamlike memory. But once you were able to set it down on stone, all of a sudden, you had this extension of your brain that could transcend time. And that was revolutionary. Printing presses, similarly. All of a sudden, you can produce mass quantities of these ideas and distribute them around the world instead of having them produced once or twice. And that is an extension of our ability to communicate with our peers.
But by using the word cannibal, mm-hmm. isn't he also putting a negative slant on that?
That's right. With digital information, it's really obvious how we are cannibalizing ourselves. In some ways, it's almost like invasion of the body snatchers. Because if you look at your Facebook profile, you recognize that it's controlled not just by you, but also by Facebook to give advertisements to your friends. So it's almost like you're allowing someone else to control your body. With previous technologies, it was a little less obvious. And there were detractors, the printing press, when you had this ability to produce mass quantities of material, all of a sudden it became a political weapon and people tried to control it. So all of these revolutions have implications, both positive and negative.
You can only wonder what McLuhan would have made of Google Glass.
Yes. The idea that you could record your entire sensory experience from cradle to grave by sticking a video camera on your eye and recording everything is just amazing. And in fact, nowadays, the storage, if you do it in low quality, would cost you about $1,000 to take a baby and record his entire audiovisual experience throughout his life.
Charles Seif's latest book is Virtual Unreality, Just Because the Internet Told You, How Do You Know It's True? It's published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're back with journalist and NYU professor Charles Seif, whose latest book is Virtual Unreality, Just Because the Internet Told You, How Do You Know It's True? It's published by Viking. I spoke with him in June, and we are re-airing that interview for you now. I asked him, could we be in a period of transition? In a few decades, people will become accustomed to what we see as new today, and they'll have something to worry about that's new to them.
Oh, absolutely. That's almost certainly the case. I think this is a revolutionary period where we are through a transition. There are going to be revolutions after this. But what's interesting to me about this particular revolution is we're already decades into it, and we're only beginning to grasp how deeply it is changing our society. I mean, down to interactions with people, that things that we did since ancient times, like go to the marketplace and hang out and chat, those sorts of things are being fundamentally transformed by new technology.
And so are things like newspapers and news from NPR and other sources that people respect, the BBC, for example. As if we are just going to the sources that we agree with, aren't we kind of diminishing the impact of the ones that used to be called the respected sources?
Well, that's a good point. There's a trade-off between breadth and experimenting with new things and playing with things that you don't trust and understand, and the tried and trusted same old that you rely on forever. And it's a good thing that the internet is broadening our horizons. But at the same time, it is also undermining the authority not just of whom we go to for information, but also the tried old people. The BBC is, in my opinion, especially if you look online, not what it once was.
And the New York Times just had a piece yesterday about the way it's been covering the call for military intervention in Iraq. Even though the Times is considered by many to be a liberal newspaper, they have been going to neoconservatives a lot more than they have to people who are opposed to any kind of military intervention.
Yeah, that's right. And the failures of reporting in the New York Times as a case aren't – you can't trace that to digital information. That's not what's causing it. That in fact, the run-up to the Iraq war, that you had the exact same pattern of reliance on bad sources and people who are trying to spin. And it was magnified through the New York Times. But what's happening in the digital era is that you're reducing the number of people who are really doing primary news gathering. And so what they say is being amplified even more with fewer contrary voices.
But Colin Powell made his 2003 presentation to the UN about alleged Iraqi weapons using a digital presentation with computer renderings. Within hours, parts of it were disproved. The U.S. and U.K. had plagiarized part of it. But still, it gave it respectability, didn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When authority buys something that is digitally altered or false, it undermines the authority to a large extent. I mean, Dan Rather fell for an exact same sort of thing. He thought that a memo, which was digitally forged, was accurate. And it, as a result, he was fired. So one of the things that's going on with authorities is that they are increasingly relying on dubious sources. And I think that because all these sources are at our fingertips with the internet, there's a laziness with reporting to challenge your authorities.
Referring to his fellow academics, the physicist Freeman Dyson has said that everybody distrusts Wikipedia and everybody uses it. What problems do you see with Wikipedia?
Well, Wikipedia is the great democratizer of knowledge. The problem with it is that knowledge isn't democratic, that there is, in many cases, a true and a false, and this is not something to be put to a vote. And while Wikipedia is a great source, that you've got a variety of stuff which is mostly accurate, it's comparable in accuracy to a lot of traditional sources.
In fact, haven't a couple of studies found that Wikipedia is about as accurate as the Encyclopedia Britannica?
That's correct. In Nature, a couple of years ago, did one of these studies. I think the methodology was a bit flawed, but the point still holds that, in fact, it's not that different from Encyclopedia Britannica. But there are certain dynamics that occur in Wikipedia that don't occur in Encyclopedia Britannica, that the Encyclopedia Britannica gets quasi-authorities, people who are supposed to know what they're supposed to be talking about, to write these articles, whereas in Wikipedia, anyone can alter them.
So they're signed in the Encyclopedia Britannica. And if the authority gets things wrong, we know who messed up.
That's right. And there's a trail. And there's a trail in Wikipedia too, but it's hidden and it's hard to find. And anyone could, as a prank, put a false fact in and it can be picked up as real.
Have you looked at the entry about you in Wikipedia?
The third line
reads, "In one review of this book, someone claims that Seif has contradicting information within the book as well as information that belittles the subject of the book as a whole."
Yes, yes. And I remember once looking to see count how many wrong facts there were, not just kind of awkward language. And it was like four or five just concrete facts of societies I belong to and things like that. But there's a rule that you're not supposed to edit your own Wikipedia page, that it's a conflict of interest, which it is, to play with your own information.
So you're correcting misinformation that is based on fact?
That's correct. You're not supposed to do it. You're supposed to actually contact someone else to do it for you.
And you tell the story of Philip Roth trying to correct something within his Wikipedia entry. Should he have just called a friend and had the friend do it?
Well, in fact, he had his biographer make a change to his Wikipedia page. It had to do with what the inspiration was for one of his characters in The Human Stain. And the biographer said, no, it is not Anatole Breuillard, when in fact Wikipedia said it was. And the biographer changed it, and within minutes it was changed back. And the biographer changed it again, and it was within seconds changed back. And no matter what, even though the biographer was an authority on Philip Roth, knew Philip Roth very intimately, he couldn't even get this information in as a footnote or as an alternate view of how the novel worked.
Britannica's 32 volumes contain 40,000 articles. Wikipedia contains over 4 million. Do capacities like that just overwhelm the problem of trying to get things accurate?
It does. It does. I mean, there's so much information there, a lot of which sits fallow for years and years without being looked at. It's amazing that Wikipedia is as useful as it is. That, in fact, it is a triumph in that this is something that if you don't know anything about a subject and you just want to get a quick thumbnail, everyone goes to Wikipedia, so it's useful. But the vast majority of these pages are very deeply flawed.
My guest is Charles Seif, S-E-I-F-E, the author of 5 previous books, including Proofiness and Zero, which won the Penn Martha Albrand Award for First Nonfiction, New York Times notable book. He is professor of journalism at New York University. His latest is Virtual Unreality, Just Because the Internet Told You, How Do You Know It's True? It's published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned the anonymity problem with Wikipedia. Well, but isn't that a problem throughout the Internet?
It is. It seems to bring out the worst in us. When we're behind a veil of anonymity, we do things that we wouldn't do to a person in real life. Yet the persona that we put online are representing us. They're our avatars. And so when they interact, they actually have real life effects.
There are fake IDs. Every once in a while it leads to a scandal. Wasn't John Mackey of Whole Foods caught writing complimentary things about himself under a false name?
There are all sorts of people who are using what are called sock puppets. They create phony personae that are supposed to be independent of themselves, that have different properties, to back them up. So it's like you have an argument with 10 or 12 people, and it turns out it's all controlled by one person.
And but sock puppets are everywhere. Doesn't the government use sock puppets?
The government does. There was, in fact, a government contract put out a number of years ago for a piece of software to create sock puppets and control them and use them in foreign websites to try to control messages. It's a psychological operation stunt.
One of the most notable cases of faked identity involves Tom McMaster. Could you tell us about him?
Yes. A number of years ago, there was a blogger from Syria, and she happened to be a homosexual woman, a liberal woman in a regime which was very conservative and breaking down. And so what she said was putting her at grave risk of getting injured or captured or hurt. And so she was blogging and people were beginning to follow her. And then all of a sudden, she disappeared. She was on her blog. It was said that she was kidnapped. She was pulled away in a car. A friend had blogged this. And there was international outrage. A number of media outlets, BBC, said, "Free Amina Aref," who was this blogger. It turns out she never existed because she was created by Tom McMaster.
Well, McMaster claimed that he couldn't find an audience for his views as himself, so that's why he invented her. Do we have any sense that that he caused any problem here? Wasn't he still really revealing something that did occur in Syria?
In some sense, what's interesting about this is that the only difference in what he was saying, other than kind of the factual elements about the physical issues with Amina, was his opinions were the same as what Amina's was projecting. But because he dressed it up in the guise of a liberal blogger from Syria, all of a sudden it was granted authority because it was supposedly a firsthand experience.
You distinguish between type 1 and type 2 sock puppets. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that you can have a sock puppet that is supposed to take on the persona of someone else, like take on the persona of a liberal blogger from Syria so you can get a additional authority. Or you can have a sock puppet that does exactly the opposite. It's supposed to be anyone but you to back up your argument and to make sure that no one could link you to the sock puppet.
WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden revealed primary sources avoided traditional American news organizations because they argued that the media has lied by omission. Is that a widely shared view in the traditional media?
Ah, that's a good point. I would say that there's always, whenever you're a journalist, there's always a selection bias. Whenever you are talking about a subject, by choosing which sources to include, which sources not to include, what quotes to include, what quotes not to include, you are steering the conversation. You are giving your opinion, even though it's in neutral guise. So that there is some truth to that, that even stuff which is said with authority in the neutral language of fact is often colored with opinion, and we're not aware of that enough.
Would the impact of WikiLeaks or Snowden, are there copycats manufacturing fake secret documents?
One would wonder. You don't know definitively whether what Snowden is saying is true. A clever person could create phony PowerPoints presentations and make them look like primary documents.
Your subtitle is Just Because the Internet Told You, How Do You Know It's True? So let's get to that. How do we know whether something is true or not?
It's not easy. It is harder with digital information than it ever has been. But there are certain tricks you can use that investigative reporters use to try to get cut through to the truth. And if I had to boil it down to one rule, is figure out anything that sticks to the fact or the person that you're trying to verify.
Nobody ever said that they had spoken to that Syrian lesbian other than McMaster. So there was no way that would have proved that maybe she really did exist.
That's right. I mean, even something as innocent as she has a mole on her lower her left cheek, something that would help you identify or verify that someone is not that person is important. So if you can get a photograph of somebody, you have someone on the web and you take a photograph, there are a number of tools that are actually very powerful to look up whether that photograph is used in other contexts. Images search, images.google.com or tineye.com allow you to see whether that photograph is used by other people. And if you have multiple people using that photograph, you know it's not true.
Some people would argue that the anonymity of the internet is what makes it special, because people can say things that they would be afraid to say otherwise. We've been hearing a lot of things about rapes on campuses, for example, through that. On the other hand, you write that fringe ideas become more potent when they're digitized. And an example you give is the 9/11 truthers.
That's right. That anonymity is, I mean, cuts two ways. That it, I mean, it, to protect ideas that need to come out but could damage the person, anonymity is very, very useful. But it also allows people to go to town on stuff that they would be embarrassed to talk about in polite company.
You describe fears about something called Morgellons disease. What is that?
Yeah, Morgellons is...
That's Morgellon. Okay.
It's from an old French term. And a number of people a few years ago had this feeling that they had bugs crawling under their skin. And they, upon examination, they saw that there were sores and little threads coming out. It was this mysterious disease. And it got the name Morgellons. In fact, the people who suffered from Morgellons petitioned the CDC to look into it, and they got an investigation. It turns out that there really is no such disease. It's a variant of what's called delusional parasitosis, which is actually very common. People feel bugs are crawling under their skin. But because these individuals who had the same feelings were able to connect with each other on the internet, they validated each other's beliefs even though they weren't true.
Are the internet and the flood of digital data just too anarchic? Is greater oversight or regulation needed?
Well, that's a good question. Regulatory oversight seldom solves the regulatory problem that you're looking for. And I'm not sure how you'd want to regulate ideas in a way that makes sense. I think what the answer is more skepticism, from the consumer, you, a realization that the landscape has shifted and the ability to change your approach to information accordingly.
Mistakes are about to happen in any medium. Isn't the real issue whether there's a way to correct the errors, a way that we can all respect?
Well, corrections go a long way towards helping, but they're not a solution because on the internet you will find a story that comes up and then a correction later, and just because the story exists, it is perpetuated. And this is true with traditional media as well.
That's why a European court has decided – is the European court or the EU decided otherwise? But that would present all sorts of other problems.
It does. It does. The right to be forgotten now is ensconced in EU doctrine. And so people are applying to get Google to erase their stuff. But of course, they're erasing valid information too. If you want to find out that someone has committed a crime, if they erase it, you're not going to be able to find it.
Charles Seif's latest book, Virtual Unreality, Just Because the Internet Told You, How Do You Know It's True, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.